The next case on calendar this morning is Pelota versus State Department of Corrections, docket number 66664. Okay, counsel, are you ready to begin? All right, come on up.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Adam Hosmer-Henner for Appellant Gilbert Pagliotta, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time.
Certainly.
The state and the district court erred by denying Pagliotta's request for religious accommodation based not on penological, but solely on theological grounds. While incarcerated, Pagliotta requested a religious diet, a traditional Egyptian diet, in accordance with his Thelemic faith. After consulting with the prison chaplain, who advised Pagliotta that such a diet was unavailable, Pagliotta then requested a kosher diet as a faith-based compromise, because that diet was already being provided to other prisoners in his facility. Both of these requests, along with several others, were rejected based on the sole premise that an individual's specific religious beliefs must be based in the formal religious doctrine of that individual's religion. Despite finding that Pagliotta was sincere with respect to both his faith and his specific request for a religious diet, the district court nevertheless granted summary judgment against Pagliotta based on that same erroneous premise, finding as a matter of law that an individual can be deemed insincere if their requested religious accommodation is not grounded in the formal doctrine of that individual's religion. Congress passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or RLUIPA, specifically to preclude the arguments that the state is now making. RLUIPA was passed to increase the protection for prisoners' free exercise rights, and it's intentionally broad to protect those rights. The definition of religion under RLUIPA is any exercise of religion, whether or not compelled by or central to a system of religious beliefs. Thus, a prisoner seeking to obtain the protections under the RLUIPA statute need only satisfy an initial burden that's in two parts. One, establishing that the prisoner has requested a religious exercise, and two, that the state substantially burdens that religious exercise.
Mr. Pagliotta has the Thelemic beliefs. Is that a form of religion, or what is that exactly?
His declared faith is Thelema. It's a recognized faith under the NDOC administrative regulations. Okay. And the definition of it, we submit, is simply sort of irrelevant to these particular proceedings because it's not the formal doctrine that matters. It's how the individual interprets his own religious beliefs. So one of the authorities we cited, Wall v. Black, and from the Southern District of Mississippi, described Thelema as a syncretic system of beliefs that incorporate multiple philosophies and religions that's based on the writings of Aleister Crowley. But that's really beside the point because it doesn't matter what the actual religion says. It doesn't matter what the religious text says. What matters is how the individual, in his own scheme of things, interprets his own religion.
Would there be a difference, like you said at the beginning, that the kosher diet is available at the prison and he would be satisfied if he got that? Let's say the kosher diet wasn't available. Where do we stand in that case? Does the prison have to make up a special diet for every inmate's religious beliefs, or what's your interpretation of the law?
The law, RLUIPA and the First Amendment are very clear on that issue, and that it puts forward this balancing test. And RLUIPA applies a compelling interest strict scrutiny balancing test. So once he has proffered that prima facie case of asking for a religious accommodation, the burden then shifts to the state, and this is really where most of the cases are decided, to show a compelling governmental interest and that their regulation is the least restrictive means of obtaining and furthering that compelling governmental interest. So here, if an individual requests a diet filled with whatever they like to eat, the point of this exercise is not to invalidate that person's individual religious beliefs, but to see whether that can be accommodated in the scope of the prison experience and context. And for the most part, these cases are resolved on those grounds, where the state says, we recognize your religious beliefs, but that we have a compelling interest in security and the orderly administration of our prisons, and on that basis, we deny your request and find that not to be a violation of RLUIPA. Here, the state and the district court never got to that balancing test. They never submitted any evidence about cost, about security, about the orderly administration.
The disposition below was just premature, and it should go back for purposes of making that determination?
Well, we submit that, but we also submit that the decision below was internally inconsistent and wrong, and we actually think you can go a little bit further than that to find that Paliota should be entitled to summary judgment, because to the extent that other prisoners are being afforded these kosher diets. And again, the record is silent on this, so remand is appropriate certainly to some degree.
So your argument would be different if, as you suggested a few moments ago, generally speaking, these situations are resolved by the state establishing the necessary consideration for orderly administration, et cetera. So it's not a free and open, I prefer lobster and steak, and I sincerely believe that. That should be recognized as your position, but then the burden shifts to the state to show why they cannot meet that in terms that would meet constitutional muster. Is that a fair statement?
That's absolutely correct, Justice Ada, and this really was cut off before the inquiry got going.
So we need a better factual determination below, or a record having been created below with respect to those considerations.
And that's really why the slippery slope argument presented by the state, that this would lead to a flood of requests, simply isn't a valid exercise here, a valid contention here, because the state always reserves that ability to say, this is part of our orderly prison administration, this is a compelling governmental interest, and we can weigh that. But what it can't do is have a preliminary debate about theology, and on that basis, on its interpretation versus Paliota's interpretation of religion, make a decision that his interpretation of his own religion is wrong, and therefore he's not entitled to even get to that balancing test.
But counsel, I understand part of that, but ultimately, even for this court, we have the ability de novo to review this, but aren't we bound by findings of fact that are made down below, which obscures the argument you're just making, that the court must accept without recourse whatever is said by this proponent of his religion, even though there's some case law, which is originally why I was going to ask you the question, what is the appropriate law that should have been considered for the test in this case, that if the district court erred, as you're putting forth?
The district court erred with respect to both the statute of RLUIPA and the free exercise religious grounds. And it erred because, and there's really nothing that this court can turn back over or defer to the district court, because its finding is internally inconsistent. Found on one hand that Paliota was sincere with respect to his faith and his religious basis for a request of a diet. And then it ultimately found that he was not sincere and that his religious request was not rooted in theological belief.
Wasn't there a centrality test that was on the books before that has now been stricken, so to speak, by the Supreme Court?
That's correct, and it's been rejected in both the RLUIPA and the free exercise context. It's been, even in Thomas, which is back in 1989, I believe, the Supreme Court started moving away from that centrality test for this reason, that it's simply impossible for a court, a judicial court, to attempt to determine where in a scheme of beliefs a particular practice or belief fits and how central that is to the core of that religion. So courts haven't been using that test for some 35 years, and yet the state seems to rely on that by claiming that only those protections that are mandated by the religious doctrine deserve protections. And that's not what RLUIPA, that's not what the RLUIPA language holds, and it's certainly not what the modern free exercise jurisprudence
I'm
holds.
A little bit perplexed by the number of times you assert that the district court found that this was a sincerely held religious belief by this plaintiff on the dietary restriction he was seeking. Because
When I read the district court's order, it seems to me to go a bit back and forth, but in the context of the RLUIPA claim, he says, because plaintiff's sincere belief that he's entitled to a religious diet isn't based on a theological conviction, but on a perceived social connection to Judaism or his philosophical understanding of Judaism, it does not qualify as a sincere religious belief. So is this first prong that your client bears the burden of establishing, truly established in this record?
My first argument to that is that looking at kosher diets, as we argue in our briefs, is really a canard, because the question is whether the traditional Egyptian diet...
Understood. I don't know what the traditional Egyptian diet is, but...
Of course, but under the Supreme Court's precedent of Holt v. Hobbs, this kind of religious compromise shouldn't then... He shouldn't be penalized for accepting a second-tier compromise.
But can its lack of demonstrated connection and the newness with which the plaintiff embraced this dietary restriction count against him in evaluating whether this is a sincerely held religious belief at the, in terms of his carrying his burden?
It can in respect to the sincerity of his belief, and that's what the court, the Seventh Circuit in Coger v. Bryan discusses.
Right.
But even there, the prisoner in Coger v. Bryan had switched his religious affiliation four times in a year.
And we don't have anything like that here?
And there's nothing like that here. What the court said is there's nothing in the record to indicate that he's not sincere. But the court went on, and I want to address what you just said about being rooted in religious belief and connected to theology. There's nothing requiring that a religious belief be rooted or connected to a specific set of theological practices. So what the district court...
But a disconnect between the two might suggest a lack of a sincerely held religious belief, or not. You're saying it cannot?
A disconnect to what? I don't think that an individual should ever be subjected to finding a declaration from a clergy member to use that to show that they're not sincere about their own belief. I think that's an impermissible judicial function, to confront someone who's requesting religious accommodation, to have evidence introduced against them in court, such as a declaration here from one of the clergy members who happened to disagree with his own interpretation of religion. I think that's fundamentally wrong, and I think the state, that practice truly needs to stop, because this isn't just a one-off where the state messed up once and started introducing evidence about this particular religion dilemma, and then use that evidence to reject his religious belief. You know, this is something that the state seems to be doing despite RLUIPA on an ongoing basis. And if you look at what the state did and what the evidence that the district court based their decision on, it was really an impermissible range of evidence across the board. They did internet research to determine what the beliefs of the dilemma were. They reached out to a clergy member of this religion to get his interpretation about the religion. And then the state, some state official, interpreted these holy books and offered their own interpretation to the district court of what those holy books meant. Each one of those pieces of evidence should be completely ignored and could not properly support the district court's determination.
So what's the test on the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate a sincerely held religious belief?
Well, one of the cases we cite from the 11th Circuit, Watts, says it's enough to simply state that that is in fact your belief. But I think I direct you to Judge Gorsuch's opinion from the 10th Circuit in Yellow Bear, which is truly comprehensive and really should stand alone as kind of the defining interpretation of RLUIPA. And in that opinion, he states it's not within the judicial competency to evaluate the truth of the belief, but it's well within the ability of courts to determine whether the believer, in fact, truly holds that belief. So the courts can decide whether the
individual... How do they determine that? How do you determine that?
Based on the timing of the adoption of the belief, if an individual is charged with drug use, do they suddenly develop a belief that drug use is part of their religion? There are all sorts of external, extrinsic credibility measures that you can use to assess the validity of the beliefs.
You're saying it's a wholly subjective determination as to the sincerity of the prisoner's personal belief.
It is, and if you look at all the case law, there are no courts that are doing that sort of subjective analysis, trying to decide whether the individual truly, whether that belief is really part of a religion. And here, Paliota repeatedly, over and over again, said, a kosher diet is consistent with my faith. I'm requesting a kosher diet because it's part of my faith and in accordance with my principles. It's not what I would choose as my first choice, this traditional Egyptian diet, but based on his interpretation of his religion, he introduced evidence from other commentators talking about the close ancestral links of Judaism and the Lema, and based on those ties, he found that he could interpret his own religion of the Lema through adhering to certain Judaic practices. And that's no different than any of the other cases we cited concerning the Messianic Jews, who are a branch of religion that incorporate both the Bible and the Jewish tradition in part of their religion. So they incorporate both aspects of those religions and adhere to some practices and reject others. But there's nothing in their religion that requires them to keep kosher. But yet some of those members feel, as part of their own particular religion, they would like to maintain that dietary practice. And repeatedly the courts have allowed them to do so. So the test here of sincerity is really, has he stated a prima facie case that he's sincere about his own belief? And again, if all he wanted was a kosher diet, he could have, and was perpetuating a fraud in the court, he could have switched his religious affiliation the next day to Judaism. If this was not a religiously based motivation for his request, and all he wanted was that diet, there's nothing stopping him from changing his faith-based declaration form, obtaining the diet he wants, and moving on. But based on his own interpretation of his religion, the state simply can't come in and present evidence disagreeing with that.
All right, and counsel, since we chewed into a bit of your time, I'm going to give you two additional minutes. Mr. Leslie, I'll do the same for you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Perigarian, members of the panel. My name is Clark Leslie. I am the Assistant Solicitor General from the Attorney General's Office. It is my privilege to represent the state in this matter. My esteemed colleague and opponent made an extraordinary statement, and he said, in essence, it doesn't really matter what the religious texts say. It's what the adherent of the religion defines it to be. Now, we're talking about individuals who are engaged in a subjective practice of belief in a penal setting, which changes the paradigm significantly and substantially. We are not talking about individuals in free society who may wish to believe any number of things that many of us would find disagreeable or a problem, and yet they would be permitted under both the First Amendment and our LUPA. We are talking about, instead, an individual who has been confined and, because of safety and security and economic and other reasons, has to have a curtailment of rights that are not enjoyed, that are otherwise enjoyed by people in free society.
But isn't that the second part of the test? I mean, that burden's on you, and we don't have those findings here, right?
Well, yes and no. We do have a finding from the district court that there is a disconnect or a failure to have a logical connection between the desire for a kosher meal versus what the Thelema religion itself says. The district court found that his preference here was philosophical and not religious. And let's remember, if we can please, the paradigm of our LUPA, which was passed after RFRA, the Religious Freedom and Reformation Act, was found unconstitutional as to the states. But after our awareness in 1968, that there had to be more than Judeo-Christian values that would be permitted to inmates. In enacting our LUPA, what we did was we took away some of the advantages that were given to state that were defeating otherwise legitimate penal prisoner cases and gave them a broader platform upon which to bring their case. So as you know, there are three parts to the prima facie case that have to be established by the inmate. First, there has to be an actual religion that is sincerely held and believed in.
But that finding was made below. Would you agree with that?
In part, it was found that Mr. Paliota had a sincere belief in Thelema and in its precepts. However, it was not found that it could be a sincere belief to hold that Thelema allows a person to demand a kosher meal.
But whose determination is that to be made? Isn't the sincere belief in their religion enough, and then the burden shifts over to the state to show why it should or should not accommodate that request, even with the compromise?
Right.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You're doing 3 points, and I've got you at number one.
No. And I'm glad you brought this up, Justice Seda. There are three primary points that have to be established by the inmate in order to have a prima facie case under RLUIPA. Number one, the actual existence and argument and belief in a religious system, whatever that might be defined as, and it's basically a belief in something bigger than ourselves and so forth. Secondly, there has to be federal government involvement, and in this case, that's the provision of federal funds, and we agree that Nevada received some funds from the federal government to invoke RLUIPA. And then third, there has to be an exhaustion of the administrative remedies. And again, we admit and agree that there was an exhaustion. If those predicate elements are established by the inmate, the burden of proof then shifts to the state to show that there was a compelling state interest in bringing forth the regulation that restricts a right, and that it was done in the least restrictive means. But we don't get there if there is a lack of sincerity or the lack of a religious component to that which the inmate is requesting, and under Shakur, under War Soldier, under Loving, under many cases that we cite, there has to be a substantial burden upon the inmate's ability to practice his or her religion by the regulation at issue. And here, in both instances, Mr. Paliota's claim fails. First of all, using their own writings, and this was the other remarkable thing that was said, that we don't look at what the writings of the religion say. We defer entirely to how the particular individual interprets those writings. Well, that is certainly not an absolute in inmate and in penal situations. We have very sincere believers in Isatru, for example, a earth-based religion, Scandinavian origin. They believe in using ceremonial spears and daggers and that sort of thing. Obviously, we don't allow that in a prison setting. They have to do without. Catholics, of course, have enjoyed the consumption of sacramental wine for years, and we do not allow the consumption of alcohol in prisons, although it is a basic tenet of Catholic
religion. But aren't you, that's the compelling, that's on your side of the compelling state interest, right?
Well, actually, it's...
Or not, you're saying it's at the first?
Well, I'm saying that you can have a so-called sincere belief in a accoutrement or an accommodation of a religion, yet in a prison setting, you're not going to be entitled to be able to use it.
Right, but I understood your argument to be that we don't even get there in this case because he doesn't get past the first.
That's right. And so to get to that point, Justice Pickering, the writings of Alexander Crowley cannot simply be ignored in this case, despite what Mr. Paliota's counsel may wish you to believe. As you'll note and you'll recall in reading the record below, Thelema adherents are encouraged to consume rich foods and wines with froth. Well, they're not going to get either of those in a prison setting. And when we look at what is the only dietary provision of Thelema, and it is not acceptable, that does not carry over a default meaning that the inmate is then free to define whatever dietary thing he or she wants. Now, the record does disclose that he was offered what many Muslims are requesting and requiring under their religion, a vegetarian meatless diet. He didn't want that. He wanted the kosher meal. Why? Because it is by far the most tasty, most preferable meal at one time that was being offered by the prison.
Wasn't that an accommodation request, though? And now it's being pushed that he wanted this kosher meal?
Yes, exactly, because
So it's a situation of why is this non-Jewish person asking for a kosher meal we've gotten into, opposed to a sincere belief, which is a tenet of what we have, kind of a statutory effect. I ask the same question. Was this not looked at improperly by the district court in applying the test, or the alleged test based on Ninth Circuit ruling presently?
The district court, I think, looked at sufficient facts in the record to determine that this was a personal choice rather than one.
Because they seem to backhand it with the centralist language, which is no longer good language.
Right. The central tenet doctrine that we existed under RFRA no longer exists under RLUIPA, and they went to great lengths to point out that a regulation is not going to be affected by the fact that it is not a central tenet of the religion. It can be something very minor, but something important to the particular adherent.
I guess I'm concerned because as it stands now, the department allows this diet to be given to other individuals who are not of the Jewish faith.
Yeah, but...
It does that. It also accommodates in others to other individuals, but yet it shows in this case to say, we're not accommodating. Whose sincere belief are we looking at? Are we looking at the departments? Are we looking at the individuals and we don't even get to the penal because that's not been put on the record?
We're looking at the individual because the individuals that are not Jewish that were getting the preferential kosher diet were able to show that in their religion there were other reasons why this diet would be an accommodation and consistent with their beliefs. The only thing that a Thelema person can point to are rich foods and frothy wine. That does not mean that since he can't get...
You already said the wine is out.
The wine is out, and he got in trouble serving food that was not deemed to be dietarily proper, so we're not getting into rich foods either. We worry because we've had people who have petitioned for the Church of Harvey's Bristol Cream, claiming that they were required to drink a fifth of Harvey's Bristol Cream every week. We had an interesting case, and I don't want to get too graphic or weird here, but there was an inmate that had a calendar with a very attractive, nude, buxom young lady on his locker, which he had to have removed. And when he complained about the fact that it was his prayer totem, he was asked, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I'm a believer of the Church of the 44s. Obviously.
Well, Mr. Leslie, I know we get kind of, it's interesting kind of these bizarre examples how this can go to extremes. We have to write up a rule in this case, I assume, that complies with RLUIPA and balances interests of the parties and in such a way as not to vex the Department of Corrections with, you know, absurd requests and things like that. How would you recommend we write that up? And I'd ask opposing counsel the same thing.
Thank you, Justice Gibbons. Matter of fact, I was hoping that question would be asked. I would frame the issue as follows. To what extent may an inmate self-define the religious accommodations he is entitled to, either under the First Amendment or RLUIPA?
But isn't that the practice of this particular religion, is that they self-define the practice?
It is. And that doesn't mean that we should allow that, because can't we see...
But as part of that, religion, then the focus does become upon whether or not it's a sincerely held belief, which the court said essentially yes until you get to the second prong, and discuss the diet itself, and that it didn't really have a religious nexus, but rather a social nexus, and therefore he granted summary judgment.
Yeah, and I mean, we're looking for that magic line where there are some things that obviously, regardless of how sincerely they may be held, an inmate is not going to be granted. And other things where they may be different, they may be, you know, off the beaten path, but they're going to be permitted nonetheless under the First Amendment. And so the question is, as this court so often is required to do, where do we draw the line? We're not going to let inmates engage in animal sacrifices, even though they may be sincere believers in Santeria. We're not going to let earth-based religions use dangerous weapons. Native Americans use antlers and peyote in some of their ceremonies, and they can do so legally. We're not going to let them use peyote in a prison, and when we do allow them to have antlers, they're limited to two tines, and they are rounded off rather than large antlers. Where do we draw the line? We do not throw out the writings and the written traditions and beliefs of the religion. We start there. And in this particular case, we then see what can be accommodated under safety and security and economic problems and issues that the prisons face. In this instance, providing the most expensive type of meal that we can to an inmate who has no historical or religious predicate upon which to draw a desire for this particular diet, we should not permit that to occur.
Mr. Leslie, was that determination made below? Were any facts presented to the district court that showed that it would be too expensive for the state to meet the needs of this particular religious accommodation?
What has happened is that the kosher meal in question was only provided to one inmate as of 18 months ago, Ackerman, under a class action suit, and even that has been forestalled now. So the particular diet that Mr. Paliota is requesting would essentially be his alone, because we are not providing.
My question was very straightforward. Was that information presented to the district court below?
No, the question of the economic cost of the meals was not presented to the district court below. It has been in other cases, but not this one.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact,
this was decided on cross motions for partial and full summary judgment. So.
Yes. And it was decided upon what I thought was a very appropriate scholastic review. Going back to the Seeger case, I cited the Kutch case. They cited several other instances involving not just inmates, but other areas that are rife with very interesting discussions about the First Amendment and freedoms. Whether or not one qualifies as a conscientious objector. In Kutch, it's whether or not you could justify drug use under a rubric of being religious in nature. We all know about the infamous Professor Leary and his LSD experiences and his attempts to justify it through a religion. We have that here. We have an individual who, after the fact, says, well, if you're not going to give me an Egyptian diet, and no one knows what that is, then I'm going to...
Beckman is completely silent on what that is, right?
It's completely silent. No one was really, and I've looked it up, and it is what it is. But there's nothing that needs to be supplemented in the record, because we have the evidence that it's a philosophical, not a religious choice. We have the evidence that the basic Thelema religion itself does not have any dietary requirements at all, other than rich foods and frothy wines, and they're not going to be getting that. So how does that translate into a right to have a special kosher meal? And there have to be limits, as there is with every right, whether it's yelling fire in a crowded theater or fomenting violence against the United States. Every right has a limit. These are individuals in a penal situation. They are subject to unique control. If not, we face the situation we faced with neo-Nazis who, in prison, were declaring themselves Jewish so they could get this meal, which was exceptionally disconcerting to many individuals. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's not a single case that the other side, that the state can cite to in support of their position. There's not one case where a court has begun by looking at a religious text and used that to demonstrate that someone's insincere. If their position is adopted...
I'm not sure that happened here. That's not the way I read this.
The district court looked at the holy texts. The district court said that the declaration from another clergy member lent some support to the idea that Paliota wasn't sincere. And there's not a single citation to the record by the state concerning any of these other diets or the status of kosher meals in prisons at all. There are no authorities to support their position. And that's because we don't want a situation where an individual comes into a district court requesting a religious accommodation and is cross-examined with the text of their holy book to say that their individual belief is not actually found in that scripture.
But your position is that this gentleman, his holy text is sincere. He sincerely is thulemic, and thulemia, or however you pronounce it, it calls for sweet, foggy wine and rich foods. We agree, everyone agrees, including you, that he can't have that in prison. So we shift them to accommodation, which is a little different, isn't it?
Not completely shifted, because it's still, what his request for a kosher diet is still religiously connected to what he's requesting. And
how does the record establish that?
He testifies to that over and over again, where he says that a kosher diet is consistent with my faith. He introduced evidence saying that the two religions were connected. He never says that I have a social or philosophical connection to Judaism. That's completely beside the point, and the district court's wrong there. What he says is that the two religions are intertwined, and therefore I can adopt some of those practices based on my own specific faith. But the issue of social or philosophical connection is beside the point. And I refer you specifically, Your Honor, to Holt versus Hobbs, where there's nothing at all on the record to say that a half-inch beard is religiously mandated under the tenets of Islam. But the Supreme Court of the United States did not reject his request for a half-inch beard based on that finding. That was an accommodation. That's what the United States Supreme Court held. And his accommodation here should be a religious diet that's as close as you can get to his religious accommodation.
All right, counsel, very interesting. We appreciate the briefs and the arguments today. This matter will stand.